You are now tuned into CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Want to know more about the channel? Find us online at cjsf.ca.
Increasingly, we are deferring decisions to AI on who to recruit, who to imprison, who to date, who to give a mortgage to, who to vote for, who to kill. To compound this sort of thoughtlessness, no one really knows how the most advanced algorithms do what they do. The training procedure in deep machine learning determines the settings of millions of parameters which interact in such a complex way that we have reached a point where even the creator of an algorithm doesn't really quite understand it completely.
That's Jude Brown, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Jude Brown on AI's promise and peril. The rise of AI, artificial intelligence, is a major development in human history. Its ramifications are profound. What is it exactly? AI provides a computer program the ability to think and learn on its own. It's a simulation of human intelligence into machines to do things that normally humans do. A government advisory committee states that the emergence of AI as a dominant technological force has brought with it a wave of transformative possibilities for society, ranging from medical breakthroughs to driverless cars to greater efficiency. However, potential dangers posed by unregulated AI development range from biases in decision-making algorithms to massive unemployment, deepfakes, privacy issues, abuse of civil liberties, and even global security. AI is a classic double-edged sword, a mix of promise and peril. Our guest today is Jude Brown. She's head of the Department of Politics and International Studies at King's College. She's the author of Political Responsibility and Tech Governance. She gave the Alan Turing Lecture at King's College in Cambridge, England, in early May 2024. And now, Jude Brown.
I had heard many times the famous quote that concluded Alan Turing's 1951 lecture, Intelligent Machinery and Heretical Theory. It seems probable that once the machine thinking method had started, it would not take long to outstrip our feeble powers. There would be no question of the machines dying, and they would be able to converse with each other to sharpen their wits. At some stage, therefore, we should have to expect that the machines will take control. Now, this is an unnerving conclusion for Turing to draw, and so many commentators on AI since have aligned these words with a presumption that Turing was resigned to humanity's eventual doom. So when I went upstairs to the King's Archive and asked for Turing's papers, I was astonished to see that this is not how the lecture finishes in its original. Turing's conclusion is actually, at some stage, therefore, we should have to expect that machines will take control in the way that's mentioned in Samuel Butler's Erewhon. Now, Samuel Butler published Erewhon in 1872. He too had been here at Cambridge, but some 80 years before Turing. And it's an extraordinary work of fiction that tells the tale of a young protagonist who discovers a remote civilization, Erewhon. Now, as the spelling of Erewhon suggests, it's not quite nowhere. That is to say, it's not anywhere that we would recognize as such, but we would appreciate some of its features as its desire to create laws and rules and customs to ensure the flourishing of its people. And now there's a great deal you could say about this book, both bad and good, but I just want to draw your attention to the fact that Butler is asking us to imagine a human society that has evolved over time, disconnected from the cultural assumptions and political society that we find ourselves in as a reader. Now, Erewhon has many customs and rules that would seem strange to us, perhaps unjust and nonsensical, and then there are some that are politically radical. One of the big decisions that the Erewhonians have taken is that they have banned machines. The drastic measure taken by the Erewhonians was influenced by a prophet who some 200 years or so before the book is set, so the story goes, has seen man's increasing obsession and subsequently reliance on machines as the essential element of humanity's decline. Indeed, the prophet predicted that the survival of the human race quintessentially depends on the halting of machine evolution, which otherwise would be the last of our planet's dominant inhabitants. So here are some examples of the Erewhonian prophet's observations about humanity's relationship with machines. The art of the machines they serve that they may rule. They have preyed upon man's grovelling preference for his material over his spiritual interests. How many men at this hour are living in a state of bondage to the machines? How many spend their whole lives from cradle to the grave, intending them by night and day? Is it not plain that the machines are gaining ground upon us when we reflect on the increasing number of those who are bound down to them as slaves, and of those who devote their whole souls to the advancement of the mechanical kingdom? Now, these fears, written by Butler in 1872, are echoed today. Yudkowsky, for example, is a well-known decision theorist and lead researcher at the Machine Intelligence Research Institute in California, and he says in what is now a famous interview in Time magazine, "Many researchers think we're plunging towards a catastrophe, with more of them daring to say it in private than in public, but they think they can't unilaterally stop the forward plunge, that others will go on even if they personally quit their jobs. And so they all think they might as well keep going. This is a stupid state of affairs, and the rest of humanity ought to step in at this point and help the industry solve its collective action problem." Most likely, Yudkowsky was thinking of Elon Musk. He said recently, "If I could press pause on AI, or really advanced AI digital superintelligence, I would. It doesn't seem like that's realistic, so my company is essentially going to build AI in a good way, sort of hopefully." So let's just remind ourselves, I know we're all familiar with it, but let's just remind ourselves some of the issues with AI. Humanity's increasing reliance on AI is driven by compelling narratives of efficiency in which the human is a poor substitute for the extraordinary computational power of machine learning, the creative competences of generative AI, as well as the speed, accuracy, and consistency of automation in so many spheres of human activity. Indeed, AI is fast becoming the core technological foundation of contemporary societies, estimated by the World Economic Forum to contribute $15.7 trillion to the global economy by 2030. Of the world's biggest 10 companies, 6 are AI tech companies. And from those sorts of companies, Apple, Microsoft, Meta, Alphabet, Google, we have thousands of remarkable products, which the Erewhonians definitely would have missed out on. We all know about search engines, autonomous vehicles, astonishing medical diagnostic tools, ChatGPT, but focusing just for a moment on a couple of recent ones, which I find particularly extraordinary. There's AI-generated medium-range weather forecasts with unprecedented accuracy, and these are used as early warning predictions for extreme weather events, floods, tornadoes, hurricanes, heat waves, Now, this technology is called GraphCast, and its training data is a rich record of global historical weather of the past 40 years. This machine learning product includes a million grid points covering the entire Earth's surface, and for each grid point, the model predicts a range of variables, including temperature, wind speed, precipitation, humidity, all at different layers of altitude, multiple layers of altitude, with extraordinary precision in a matter of seconds. And such a product is not only useful for everyday human planning, but a game changer for food security, emergency responders, and climate change researchers, and a plethora of other applications. Another one which is extraordinary is AlphaFold, which has predicted how 200 million proteins fold from a chain of amino acids into 3D shapes that enable them to carry out life's functions. And in fact, my mother-in-law's life work was making models to fold these proteins, and it would take a whole career to find one of these and get its folding into perspective. And this extraordinary AI product has provided vital information for nearly all known proteins to develop vaccines for malaria, for COVID. And it's essential to cancer drug discovery and has led the way to something I find really extraordinary, which is plastic-eating enzymes, which is being used now to tackle the 400 million tons of plastic waste that we produce every year. So these are, without doubt, huge benefits to our society. But of course, as we all know, set against a backdrop of remarkable technological innovation is a deep public anxiety about the prospect of AI-generated harm. We're familiar with it. Abuse of our personal data, sexist and racist biases of humanity being firmly compounded into our society by AI trained on the data of our behaviour and our views, deep fakes, misinformation. Another is technological unemployment. And I just want to spend a few seconds on this, really. Many studies and reports from academia and the corporate world make predictions on the fate of a range of human jobs. And most of these reports predict that by 2030, very much within our sights, some 30 to 40% of human-centered labor tasks will be at the risk of AI and robotic replacement. And you can see that the potential for automation of certain tasks in banking, energy, health, public service, defense is extremely high. We're repeatedly being told that the projected productivity gains in the trillions will be in those sectors where the most opportunity to substitute human labour are predicted to be those that are likely to see the largest productivity gains from AI. And a recent example is the announcement by BT that it will cut 55,000 jobs in light of the opportunities of AI by 2030. Now, the term technological unemployment was popularised by another King's Fellow, whose room we're in, named after him, John Maynard Keynes. And incidentally, he had been enormously impressed by Alan Turing and had been one of the academics responsible for permitting him into King's as a young scholar. Now, Keynes's famous article entitled Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren started out as a lecture to students here at King's in 1930. Keynes was worried that students disillusioned with social and economic inequality would be allured by communism. And he sought to convince them that if they were to hang on, new technologies would bring an end to material need. For Keynes, this was to be but a temporary phase of maladjustment, during which time technology would replace human labour to the detriment of the masses in the short term, but that in the longer term, it would in fact solve mankind's economic problems. Indeed, Keynes predicted that within 100 years of his writing, the UK's population could reach our destination of economic bliss, whereby technical efficiency would rise to such an extent that absolute material need would be satisfied with the minimum of labour effort. There will, he says, be ever larger and larger classes and groups of people for whom problems of economic necessity have been practically removed. And Keynes was very much looking forward to this future. I look forward, therefore, in days not so very remote to the greatest change which has ever occurred in the material environment of life for human beings in the aggregate. And today we have scholars such as Winchester, for example, who echo Keynes, that algorithmic revolution that's coming down the line will potentially release humans from what he sees as all the unnecessary knowledge that we carry around in our minds to facilitate labour that could be performed by AI. And he sees that this is freeing the potential for new forms of human genius. What others, including myself, have been less optimistic. With the rise of zero-hour contracts, economist and tech investor Bill Janeway here at Cambridge argues that it's not hard to see how the digitally enabled gig economy could become the ultimate realization of Marx's reserve army of labor, fully commodified human beings available to capitalism on demand. And under these increasingly precarious conditions, low to mid-skilled labor could be reduced to ever lower paid tasks that cost less than the costs of the automation. And on this particular point, Marx's observation in 1867 translates directly to contemporary concerns. The Yankees have invented a stone-making machine. The English don't make use of it because the wretch who does this work gets paid for such a small portion of his labor that machinery would increase the cost of production to the capitalist. In England, women are still occasionally used instead of horses for hauling barges because the labor required to produce horses and machines is an accurately known quantity, while that required to maintain the women of the surplus population is beneath all calculation. Hence, we nowhere find a more shameless squandering of human labor power for despicable purposes than in England, the land of machinery. The real challenge to the average person, then, is likely to be wage decline, unless politics gets its act together. What is more is that in the face of the disruptions to the labour market, many of the least educated are at the highest risks of AI, and the macro-structural dynamics also that would ensue from high rates of technological unemployment. And with something of Keynes's optimism, for example, the UK government has freed up £117 million to fund PhDs for AI research, which is phenomenal, of course. But researching at the level of PhD caters to a tiny proportion of the future labour force, and it's not clear what those with less specialist training can expect in terms of employment opportunities in the future. So where is AI going? Well, in its sort of more basic form these days, you have supervised learning, so that's to say there's a human that teaches the machine what to do. You have unsupervised learning, is where AI spots patterns without help from us, but doesn't really know what to do with these patterns. So that's clustering, like the photos you get on your phone, for example. It will recognize a face or a particular dog and cluster those pictures, but there's nothing else kind of to it. Then there's reinforcement learning, and this is where the humans give feedback to AI's processes on whether it's got things right or wrong. And eventually, the AI is able to work out, you know, what is wanted, and it teaches itself. Artificial general intelligence is quite a leap from this kind of AI. It's to the capability of thinking for itself in abstract ways and a multitude of contexts with zero human input. And the leading futurist, Amy Webb, on AI says, it's inevitable. There's no off button. We're on our way to artificial general intelligence. And Shane Legg, who's the co-founder and chief scientist of DeepMind, says, we could have AGI by 2030. Certainly, it's going to be within 30 years. Now, Stuart Russell, who's one of my favorite computer scientists, and I would advocate listening to pretty much everything he says, is at the University of California in Berkeley. And he says, put very simply, AGI systems that are intelligent and almost certainly they'll be more capable than humans along all relevant dimensions of the intellect, those systems would be, in a real sense, more powerful than human beings. It's completely irresponsible to simply go ahead with this technology. So looking at the positives and negatives of AI, Amy Webb, the futurist, sets out two futures. The first future is a sort of optimistic account of AI that we see in the domestic and foreign policy initiatives of states and international organizations and the glossy materials of management consultancies and corporates, a future where AI development is grounded in the public interest with transparency requirements built into AI system designs, where humans are in the loop to provide oversight, individuals have control over their personal data, and where AI is supposed to support human labour rather than replace it. The second future is catastrophic, where power is concentrated in the handful of AI companies who aggressively curate user needs according to their own interests, with very negative all-round effects for the rest of us humans. Webb gives the optimistic future a 20% chance. So what are we doing to resist that catastrophic scenario? There have been a multitude of non-binding corporate national and international ethical guidelines which have been largely meaningless and ineffectual. As Timnit Gebru, who was sacked from Google for criticising her employer's ethical approach, says, companies are just not going to self-regulate. We need regulation and something better than just a profit motive. Aside from ethical frameworks and self-regulating guidelines, there have been some serious attempts to get out in front of AI, most notably the EU AI Act. The cornerstone of the AI Act is a classification system that determines the level of risk an AI technology could pose to the health and safety or fundamental rights of a person. And the framework includes, you know, four tiers: unacceptable, high, limited, minimal. Now, AI systems within limited or minimal risk, like spam filters, for example, are allowed to be used with little requirements. Whereas, and there are very few examples in the unacceptable category, but where there are, an example of it would be generic biometric social system scoring, which is reportedly used in China with the general population, and that sort of thing is prohibited under the EU AI Act. Now, the Act really does have teeth, in that it has the power to fine up to 7% of a company's global revenue. That's a hell of a lot of money for some of those big tech companies. So that's a serious piece of legislation. And whilst it's impressive on many levels, and I'm an advocate of it, if we think back to Heroinian Prophet, however, his concerns were much broader than averting a set of AI-related hazards, but rather the wider question of what sort of society do we want to live in? And what sorts of relationships do we want to have with technology? These are the bigger structural questions that go beyond reactive pieces of legislation like the EU AI Act. Now, although a controversial thinker with some views I don't share, I find Arendt's idea of thoughtlessness incredibly powerful in explaining how we fail to take up political responsibility to change something in society that may be acceptable according to the norms of that given society, but when you really step back and think, you realise that actually, politically, something really ought to be done. It's that collective action problem that we heard about at the beginning. Thoughtlessness, she says, is the heedless, recklessness, or hopeless confusion or complacent repetition of truths, which have become trivial and empty, seems to me to be among the outstanding characteristics of our time. The rise of AI, I suggest, makes us thoughtless. And I suggest it does that in two ways. The first is that increasingly AI is literally thinking for us. Asa Raskin, who's the former head of the user experience at Mozilla, explains that 2 billion people will have had a thought this morning that they didn't intend to have because a designer at Google said, this is how notifications work on that screen that you wake up to in the morning. And we really have to stop and think about that for a moment. 2 billion people. Increasingly, we are deferring decisions to AI on who to recruit, who to imprison, who to date, who to give a mortgage to, who to vote for, who to kill. To compound this sort of thoughtlessness, no one really knows how the most advanced algorithms do what they do. The training procedure in deep machine learning determines the settings of millions of parameters which interact in such a complex way that we have reached a point where even the creator of an algorithm doesn't really quite understand it completely. This is what is meant by the black box of AI and is becoming not so much a question of ignorance, but rather one of impossibility. So not only then are we perhaps losing something of our capacity to think for ourselves, we're also relying on AI that is increasingly opaque, and we also tend to assume that AI is authoritative because it has more data available to it than we do. AI gives the impression that data is selective as a particular output that has been definitively identified. That is to say, it has somehow been reduced down to an essence. This gives us the impression that the AI output has been placed beyond doubt. And yet, GPT, for example, is not an oracle of knowledge in the conventional way that we might think of and sort of don't stop to think about carefully. It is rather an algorithm that creates sentences based on the probability of a word occurring in a similar sentence within a large portion of the internet. That's what ChatGPT is. And according to OpenAI, who produce GPT, it has something in the region of a 29% error margin. And that's, I mean, that's obviously very variable on how you interpret the text as well. So another example of where the space for doubt is diminishing is in the context of AI weaponry. And already some of these products have moved from a human in the loop, which is where a human takes the decision to engage the weapon according to its proposed target, to human on the loop, where the human's role is merely to override the AI weapon if they judge it to be an error. Now, the appeal to militaries, of course, is the scale and speed with which these weapons can operate, but that, too, is the basis of public concern. The scale of an error is unfathomable. Now, in his 2023 new agenda for peace, the UN Secretary General calls for states to conclude by 2026, and there has been quite a lot of movement on this, a legally binding instrument to prohibit lethal autonomous weapon systems that function without human control or oversight. And AI scientists, such as Stuart Russell that I mentioned earlier, have been tirelessly campaigning in favour of such a ban. And I would urge you to listen to his BBC Reith lecture on the subject. So the second way in which AI can make us thoughtless, in the Arendtian sense, is the enormous power that tech companies have to mould our society in the shape of their interests. So that is to say, we're all increasingly living in a world both physically and socially designed by a handful of tech companies and whatever their commercial objectives happen to be. If you think about what the futurist Amy Webb says, she reminds us that actually, when we think politically, we mustn't be distracted by the assumptions of techno-determinism. She says, we should move beyond a techno-determinism that often takes two forms. One, which is techno-dystopia, you know, the catastrophe, and two, technology that will save us. It's inevitable and necessary. These are two seemingly very different outcomes. Both assume that we simply are affected by technology. She asks, how do we shape the material and digital infrastructure of our society? We should not assume that any technology is inevitable. Now, one of the obstacles we face in answering these questions, of course, is that our democratic systems are struggling, as David Runciman and John Dunn and others have argued that what modern politics most pressingly requires is a democratisation of prudence, a spreading out of the burden of judging and choosing soberly about political questions across the entire adult population. Of course, part of the problem in getting there is that how do we get people to engage? Human beings are busy with their lives, leisure time is a premium, sorting out policy is not really a high priority for them. There's no time to engage in well-informed, thoughtful political deliberation in their everyday lives. Even for those who attempt to engage with the details of political debate before making a considered decision, most are only able to scratch the surface with little grasp of the detail, wider context, or future implications. This is what Downs calls